Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. We made this.
Hello, everyone. This is Tony, network chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or maybe you're just about to listen to. We're not going anywhere, but we'd love to keep the lights on for even longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and, well, you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. Just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis. And get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.
X-Cast. The truth is in here. I'll be your host today, Russ Hugo. Joining me is our good friend, Jim Beard. How goes life?
Hey, good, thanks. It's good to be back here.
Today's episode is Hungry. It's season 7, episode 3, directed by Kim Manners, written by Vince Gilligan, and it originally aired November 21st, 1999. The IMDb rating for this is actually 8.1. And wow. If you consider the opening Myth Arc episodes, the Sixth Extinction 1 and 2, and then the following episode, Millennium, those all have 8 on IMDb.
That surprises me even more. I haven't watched this since 1999, you know, other and then today. And the thing that struck me right off the bat is even though it's basically a Columbo story, here we are in season 7, and they were still giving us episodes that could have been, you know, in season 1, like these basic monster of the week type episodes. So there, and you'll pardon the pun, there must have been still a hunger for these among the fans at the time, if they're still doling them out all the way into season 7.
Well, yeah, and they dole them all the way into season 11 to a larger, I mean, a little bit more connected maybe in seasons 10 and 11, but there's still quite a few standalone monster of the weeks. And season 8 and 9, definitely. It's the formula of the X-Files, and it gives them a lot of freedom.
Yeah, I'm surprised that this far into the show that there would be anything new under the sun to have as a monster of the week. So really, it kind of comes down to the way it's handled. And from what I understand, this was more or less a first for the show. And I joked and called it a Columbo, you know, type of story. But that is sort of the setup that we know who it is in the beginning. And then the perpetrator it gets harassed by our heroes until the big denouement.
It is very much Columbo. And there was, I believe, a quote from Vince Gilligan, who wrote this, who wanted to make it a story that was very much from the monster's perspective and show the monster in a much more sympathetic role. After reading that, I wasn't sure that this was actually the first time that this has happened on the X-Files. I think this combination of things to where we're having a strongly sympathetic and we're spending most of the time with the quote unquote monster. It definitely is. But we could think of Tombs as an example or lots of other things where we kind of know who it is. We're shown right away from the beginning. And there's other episodes where the quote unquote monster is a little bit more sympathetic or at least not shown to be abstracted from conflict in their actions.
Yes.
I mean, think of anything like the postmodern Prometheus or something like this. But this may be, as you're saying, it's season seven where, you know, they've gone through all of the big distinctions. So here we're going to play around with this shape of focus and this form. And that, again, shows to me that the X-Files could go on, if curated well, for 20 seasons, because there's different locations and different character types and a lot of different groups of people that we could explore.
And then on top of all of that, there's been all of the X-Files fiction. And yes, and I've been involved in that. But, you know, so there's that many more stories that could be told beyond what's in the episodes. And it worked out well that this one gives so much focus to the monster that we don't get a whole lot of Mulder and Scully, but that works out well because they weren't, from what I understand, they weren't really fully available, that they were filming movies at this time. And that they had to really cut down on the availability that they had to be in this episode.
Yeah, David was filming Return to Me, I believe, and Gillian Anderson was filming House of Mirth.
Hmm. Yeah, I also read that they used a lot of body doubles, that there was only a few times that the two stars were actually together in scenes. I think it said something like they only had 2 days of filming where they were actually there at the same time.
Yeah, and variety, give them a break.
Mm-hmm. Something like that can work if we're given other characters that are interesting and hold our interest through the whole thing. And I would say that this guy, this monster, was interesting. He's definitely sympathetic. I think you can feel for him by the end of the episode.
Just before we jump in and go through the episode, let's start with your overall feeling and rating of the episode. What would you give this? On a scale of 1 to 10.
Wow. I'm going to say a 6. I won't go right in the middle. I'll go a little bit higher because, again, it was an interesting character. I liked that we knew who it was pretty much in the beginning. I had questions about the character at the end. There was a little bit more that I think I'd like to know. But, you know, overall, it was very interesting. And I actually liked the character of the psychiatrist also. There's a lot of, stereotypes in there. The bully guy at work and the neighbors and things like that. But for a Monster of the Week, it was pretty solid.
I'd probably give it about a 5. And that's, again, to clarify, it's been a while since I've been on. And I, like you, it sounds like grade on the full scale. I'd like to have an even distribution. 5 is average. It's decent. Let's dig in. This episode takes place in Costa Mesa, California. And during the cold open, you can see some nice direction here by Manners. Starts off with this really fancy crane shot. Coasts over the Lucky Boy sign, down, does an aerial view of the car, and that same cold open ends with another crane shot, which is a nice flourish for television at the time. The Lucky Boy sign, I thought the aesthetic of it was fairly well done. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how much of it was the original sign, as Lucky Boy is a real restaurant chain, and I checked, is still in business.
Oh, okay. My guess is that the figure, the mascot thing...
Yes.
That's the made-up part.
Yeah, it is, and that's the weak link in the opening for me.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that, because the first thing I said was, oh, I've always liked, fake fast food restaurants in TV shows. It's always interesting to me to see what the people who work on shows come up with when you can't have McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, whatever. So that was like, oh, cool. We get, a fake one. Let's see how good it is. But the mascot, I will go on record as saying, I doubt if any real world fast food place would ever have a mascot that looked like that. To me, it was like a very negative looking figure. What did I read? That they wanted to call it Burgerlicious, but there was that the Lucky Boy sign that they couldn't remove from the location that they wanted to use, so they just went with that.
I think that the figure that they modified on the sign sums up part of the issue for me. It does make the episode feel a little bit more kitschy in the sense that it's playing off of very mid to early 90s stereotypes, but it takes place in the late 90s.
Right.
Or at least, the episode does take place in the late 90s because we see dates on prescription bottles later to confirm that. Yeah. But for example, that aesthetic of the Lucky Boy figure as being intentionally grotesque, or for a lack of a better word, satanic, in the sense of it's looking like a haunted doll.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Evil,
right.
Like Chucky.
That's
edge.
What I'm saying. No real world restaurant chain would have anything like that. You know damn well that was not anything that was just sitting around, that they made it up for the show.
There is a line that you can cross that I think they could have gone for, which is the so exaggerated or so cute that it becomes disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
That play that a lot of the early 90s did of trying to subvert 40s and 50s aesthetics and to make them ironic or aggressive in their way. And this pushed it too far into the intentional.
Yeah.
As opposed, it's like, for example, there's the so bad it's good film genre.
Right.
And that
right.
You can't force it. I mean, maybe you can for some people, but the difference between something that was unintentionally made that is so bad it's good versus films or art that people intentionally make to try to be bad so that people will be able to appreciate it in that way.
Yeah.
This is an example of that. The sign is like the Sharknado to Troll 2 in that category there.
Okay.
And with Agreed. The other aesthetics that are playing through, and I'm sorry to overuse that word, in this cold open, just feels dated from that 5-year jump. And I wonder how audiences would have noticed it. Just maybe it doesn't feel dated. It feels inauthentic. And that is something about season 6 and some of season 7 that doesn't resonate as well with me, is that it feels a little too, sorry to say this, Hollywood. It's a little too glossy and a little too cartoonish. And for example, we have the guy pulling up in the cold open who's in a car. He's dressed and behaves like an early 90s grunge character.
Yeah,
he's listening to music that came out in 1998. I looked it up on the IMDb page. I did some research. It's a band called Unearthed.
Oh,
can't
it's
find
real.
Anything else
okay.
about them.
Well,
yeah, it's a real band.
Wow.
And they've got 4 albums I found that are still available on Bandcamp, 2 that were in 94 and 95. I don't know how much people are going to care about this, but I'll share it anyways. They were much more metal, kind of grindcore. And then in 98, they released this album where the song came from that's more hardcore, but you can really still hear the metal roots in it.
Okay.
And if you listen to it in full volume, I could imagine somebody listening to that in 1998, 99. Maybe, but at a low volume, when I hear it, it just sounds like your average grunge metal music from the early. I mean, because honestly, that genre was going back into the late 80s, but it was associated so much that style of metal and rock with the early 90s. With the haircut, it just felt cartoonish. It felt like in the 90s or in the mid 80s, we have punk rockers appear in films. To potentially be the antagonist. No one really dresses like that. It wouldn't be a problem, and it's still not a problem, but it makes it takes me out of the film even more because it's in LA. It's in Costa Mesa, and that I'm supposed to believe that somebody is dressing like that and acting like this. I'm not immersed at this point now. I'm really seeing a pastiche, but it feels like a dated pastiche and something that I'm surprised that Vince Gilligan and Manners and the casting people were so disconnected at that point from youth culture that they would make something that it's like the Sears catalog version of grunge. It's just, you know, seven, 8, 9 years too late.
Yeah. And I didn't believe the driver character for a moment. And I had written the music off almost immediately as just something generic. You know, one of those things where, you know, like in the 60s, they would have some kind of fake Beatles thing in the background, you know, when they didn't want to pay a license or whatever. So that's very interesting that it's actually a real band. Well, there are completists out there, I'm sure, that will be now tracking down those albums.
They're available for Bandcamp, and I think they're free. I think the bands put them up there. That's very kind of them. And it's not bad if you're into hardcore of that era.
I do feel the need to call out here in this opening and with this character that we're talking about that we do get the first of three references to male genitalia in this episode.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Thank you for the unpleasant reminders.
Yeah, okay. I thought once we got to that third reference, it was a little excessive.
The other thing I noticed is that the menu only has three options, plus a side of fries and some drinks, but that you could get six pieces of chicken and fries for $2.25.
Oh, get me a time machine.
What a world. And there goes our arteries at that point. Although, to go back to the first victim, I thought he at least did a good job making you hate him, and it was seemed like a really fun part to play, and he was doing his best, so I thought that actor did a good job of, I mean, everything else is so cartoonish, he's playing to the sets, he's doing what he needs to, and that is one of the performances in here that I think works really well for being fun.
I like the performance when he dropped being a jerk and he started to realize that maybe something else was going on, and he actually got a tiny little bit of sympathy from me when he's like, "Guy," and then he crawls out of his car and looks in the window. I don't know why, but I liked that moment.
So speaking of, what do you think about this sped up jump scare, the pulling of the body in and like the cartoonish squishing sound effects? What is your feeling about the coda of the cold open?
All I have to say is when it's revealed who the monster is, I almost wanted to run it back and slow down the jump scare to see if it really looked like, you know, what we saw later, like that same guy, I'm sure they...
It does.
I didn't really think much about it anyways, because it was a very, very typical setup for that sort of thing. There's some monsterific stuff later that I like, but I really didn't think much of anything at this point, like, other than, okay, yep, that's the, you know, typical opening, sure, okay, let's go.
It felt a little bit more artificial to me than other X-Files kills, and again, like, this entire episode feels a little bit less real, less grounded than other X-Files episodes in a lot of ways. That doesn't make it bad. It makes me question and think about, and this is a question I have for you to kind of think about. Maybe we can talk about it more as we go on. How might this episode have manifested in the third or fourth season of The X-Files when they were in Vancouver and they had hit their production stride? I'm not sure we would have had the high-speed camera, jump scare, cartoonish physics, over-the-top sound effects. I also think the way that the characterization is done of the main protagonist slash antagonist would have been handled differently, even if you're looking at something like DPO. But you don't have to answer that now unless you want.
All I can say is we probably wouldn't have known as much as we did as early on. And chances are our stars wouldn't have been filming movies at that time, and they would have been in it maybe more. And it would have then kind of had a whole sort of different feeling to it.
We cut to 3 days later when we come back from the credits and we meet.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18
plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. In standard human form, Rob Roberts, played by Chad Donnella, pulls up in a small car, hunched over, as a creaky, wispy voice affect. First thing we hear out of his mouth is, "You are your own man, and you control everything you do." According to the wiki, Manners was pleased with Donnella's performance, calling him a great little actor. At which I thought, is that a slightly offensive? Is it slightly offensive to use that diminutive title? And also, does that connect to the trope that's often talked about here in the X-Cast of Vince Gilligan writing little men or small men who want to or think they are great? Which doesn't really apply so much here as it is more dealing with the powerlessness, power dynamic here. It's not the same Patrick Modell or something like that. There is a lot of foregrounding of characterization here. We have the small car. We have the performance just, it does not feel natural. It feels exaggerated in so many ways.
It does. To me, he gets better as he goes along. And there is a few moments, I think, where he shines. Otherwise, yes, it's kind of a stereotype. But now, I had no real memory of watching this episode, although I know that I did. So I thought that it was probably, it could be a fooly, like he's the first guy that we see when the episode begins properly. He's the first one we see. He's odd. So immediately we're going to think, well, he's the guy. He's the monster. And I use it, quote unquote, tense moment where they're asked to show the buttons and he doesn't immediately show his. And you go, oh, and then you go back to, oh, well, it is him. And then he has his button. And it kind of goes back and forth. And then the jerk character is introduced. But then we learn very quickly that Rob really is our guy.
To put all my cards out on the table, I find his performance to be the weak link in the episode. He does have some good moments, and I think he's a good actor. But the voice, especially the voice and a lot of the affect of it.
Oh, so you, and I'm not criticizing you for it. So you see it as he's doing a voice then.
Yeah.
See, I guess, I mean, you know for a fact that he's doing a voice. You know that.
Well, I know because there are moments where he's acting that he doesn't do it.
Okay, I see what you mean. Boy, I guess I think I was all in for that. And there were a few times where I noted that in my mind that, like, wow, his voice is kind of annoying. That's a shame. But I used to say this a lot, that X-Files was an incredible opportunity for actors who had all kinds of weird things going on. Like, you know, okay, so you're not a pretty boy or a pretty girl. Well, you can have a guest spot on the X-Files. You know, we need people with crooked noses. We need people with, you know, crazy eyes. We need people whose hair is falling out. And we need people who have weird voices. And I guess I just figured he was one of these guys that he had a strange voice, and so he could be on the X-Files. But yeah, I don't know why I didn't really see it as affected. Okay.
Again, I could be wrong, but my perception watching it feels forced, and it goes back to the repeated aesthetic that they keep using, which is the early 90s. It feels like he is doing a early 90s, like if he was in Encino Man and he might be playing Pauly Shore's sidekick, even though Pauly Shore was sort of the sidekick in that film, but it has that feel of early 90s. The whole thing screams early 90s. And when you're trying to get an actor to come across in a sympathetic manner with the dynamic that we're having visits with a mental health therapist, we're dealing with murder and cover-ups, and this is the weak link. It doesn't ruin the episode, but a swing between hyper-aggressive and the way that he interacts with people at his work and some of the other questions being asked, it might have been a little bit better to play it a slightly more internalized. Because everything else is so externalized, the car, the posture, the clothing, the apartment.
I was going to say, living alone, you know.
Everything is externalized.
Yeah.
His voice, the iconography of his workplace. We could have used a little bit more subtlety. And perhaps like a performance similar to what John Cusack did in Better Off Dead. You can still do the stereotype 50s milksop, if that's, I hope that's not an inappropriate word, but not have to play it up so much. Because I think through the voice, he's trying to play tired or resigned or exasperation, but it doesn't play so well with the passion that's driven by the hunger. And then it also comes across as just being an affect. And it makes me get, I'm watching somebody try to act.
Let me just offer this, and it's going to sound like I'm defending all of this, but
you should be.
Okay. No. I found this a lot. It's television, and that's not to say that television shouldn't have good actors or anything like that, or good scripts or whatever, but I think some of it might be because of the time constraint. I was just talking with somebody earlier about the Green Hornet 60s show. I did a huge rewatch of that for a podcast about a year ago, and our biggest complaint was it was a half-hour show. And once you took the commercials out, it's 20-something minutes. And every single time, that was our complaint. There's no time to develop anything. You see glimmers of things, and you want more time, or you want it developed, and there just wasn't. Like, the show really needed to be an hour-long show. Now, we get X-Files, and it is an hour-long show, but I'm thinking that some of this is this shorthanding that goes on, that, you know, we need to get in, tell the story, and get out. And I think that's part of it. The other part is the relationship between the director, the script, and the actor, and where they cross over in the Venn diagram. I see the things that you're saying, but it didn't stick out to me at that time. He's a pretty standard, he's the loner guy, all those things that you said, and I totally get that. But in the end, I did actually feel sympathy for him. Like I said earlier, I had some questions about his monsterism, that it wasn't one of those things where it's okay to leave some things vague. There was some, you know, things that I really wanted to know, like why brains and when did this actually begin in his life? I'll offer that and then I'll just leave it there.
And to be fair, I don't want to say that Chad Donella is a bad actor.
I don't think you are saying that at all.
But compare it to Giovanni Ribisi's performance in DPO, which is a very similar character who's just a little bit more sociopathic.
Yeah.
It, in so many ways, that episode is just steeped in 90s youth culture in a Hollywood rapper. But it's still, even there, it feels more realistic than what I'm watching here.
Yeah.
It just feels like a human. I guess what I'm trying to say is I appreciate your point, but the problem with it is we're spending the entire episode with this character.
Yeah.
And this affect and these exaggerated semiotics, which we get in that first 10 seconds with the character, is repeated throughout the episode.
Mm-hmm.
We really don't get anything new except for the stomach pain, rumbling, resist, anger scene. That's about it. I mean, I think maximum development spent maybe 1 minute of screen time throughout the episode. That again goes back to where I think if they could have internalized some of the performance, you already know who the killer is.
Right.
We already kind of can tell most of what they want us to know. I guess maybe turning back to what you're saying is they don't tell us any of the practical context for where this character comes from. Because considering all the things we later learn, how does this character hear? Does not have ear holes. How did this character afford that apartment in LA working at a fast food job by themselves?
Yeah.
And not only that, how do they afford incredible prosthetics, an incredible wig, incredible eye coverings, the ear?
Okay, wait, that's on my list. That's in my notes. I don't know if you want to do this now.
We can. I mean, might as well. We can step back and state it's X-Files. It's fantasy.
Yeah.
So we don't need to explain everything. But considering we're talking about an individual's struggle with these problems, and the episode lets us explore this through this person's connection to other people, shouldn't we have some hint of a context about parenting, where this person came from, anything?
I said it too, and I agree. You know, what you're saying is you want us to spend more time with this character than maybe we have spent with other monsters in other episodes. If so, then we need more. You know, we like just don't drop him into our laps and he's a monster and you get a little bit of, you know, his frustrations. I get it. About the prosthetics, I actually made a note at one point and I wrote, a fake ear would still look like a fake ear. When he first has the thing about the ear falling off, I said, no, it's a fake ear. Like, people would notice. He's out in the daylight. He's working, you know, in close quarters in a well-lit place, a restaurant. Somebody would say, boy, your ears look fake, right?
Or if that one fell off that easily, you're telling me in a lunch rush, one doesn't accidentally fall into the French fryer at some point?
And you, like you said, I think he does actually have some kind of ear holes. There was a... I'll try not to be crude. What he had for ears looked sort of like a posterior rear end. If there's holes, they're tiny little holes. So like no one ever stood close enough to him and said, your ear holes don't go into your head. A fake ear is still going to look like a fake ear. There's no prosthetics at this time in the late 90s, I don't think, that would have passed that well for
this just goes back to the entire episode, which is very cartoonish. None of this is explained. As an example, when he's later eavesdropping on Mulder and Scully in the fast food restaurant and turns on the microphone in the drive-thru,
which was clever.
It would be, except there's no way in any reality he would hear anything, considering they're facing away from the microphone and about 10 feet away. I can do that right now with a much more powerful microphone that's actually meant for picking up a distancing, and you wouldn't be able to hear anything, especially through that speaker. It's a cartoon, and that's where I'm actually going to put the responsibility not on Manners, who I think is doing a really good job. He's putting a lot of effort, especially in staging these scenes. I think there are some beautifully shot scenes in this episode. I'm putting this on Gilligan. It's a really difficult balance to make something humorous that has pathos.
Yep.
You've got Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose as a classic example. And they nailed it, but you have to, again, explore a lot of interior feelings, I think, in the examples of The X-Files where it happens. Very difficult to think of examples where they try to explore things and make it cartoonish and it pulls off. We think the penultimate episode of season 7, I can never pronounce it. I'm not even going to try because I will offend folks. That is very, very cartoonish. We're not exploring psychology. And I think it works a little bit better for that reason. My hunch is Manners and everybody else read through the script and realized the serious aspects don't really make any sense at all. That's okay.
Right.
There's a lot of funny quips intended to be, and some actually that land for Mulder's character.
Oh.
Let's play up the cartoon angle. It's not the subtle, calm wit of a Darren Morgan, like Clyde Bruckman or something. This is much more in your face.
But what
slap
is,
sticky.
Right?
Scene after scene, things happen in this episode that don't really make sense in the real world.
Yeah.
So for that, I think Manners and the team made the right call in making it cartoonish. My issue then, going back to the main character's voice and affect, is if we're going to spend all this time with this character, we need to make them likable. And
he was likable at all?
I think you're sympathetic, but he's not given any charisma because we don't know anything about him. We're not given anything. What is this person's hobbies? What does this person want to do? What does this person dislike? Who are this person's friends? We get one scene where he gets along with people in the restaurant and then seems to form a friendship with the neighbor. But we don't know anything about this person. It's a blank slate. I think that's, for me, where the episode falls. It doesn't ruin it. There's still a lot of stuff we'll get to that's good.
Yeah.
But I think the director wasn't given a lot to work with, but Manners seemed to be happy with the performance. So that's maybe what Manners was going for. I would have really, in hindsight here, as a director, armchair director, who, again, how much do I know what I'm talking about? I'm criticizing their fine work. Would have done something through the direction to big up what was not in the script and provide me with some charisma with my lead character. Because I think it's in the actor. There are moments in this episode that the actor does shine, and you see there is something there.
Yeah.
If they just would have been given that chance to breathe.
I could see some things coming even in maybe like set dressing, as far as putting things in the apartment that might have hinted at hobbies, interests, things like that. Again, I'm not so sure that there's enough time to have gotten all that. Again, I'm not trying to excuse the whole thing, because really where I'm at right now is an average episode that's pretty much filler. Maybe nobody really took this one seriously enough.
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, they're filming 20-some episodes in a year. It's incredible.
Yeah.
But I do think there was time in the screen time to do something, because so many scenes are repeated and actually have no importance in the episode. For example, why do we need the detective character?
As far as needing another murder, another victim, right.
You don't even need it for that.
I totally agree with that. I guess it was supposed to be cute that we think it's Mulder until we see that it's not.
Yes.
And then I learned that that's actually like his body double, Duchovny's.
Yeah, and I know we're jumping around. Of all the jokes they could have made in the episode, they didn't do the easiest. When later Mulder's confronting and shows him the pamphlet and says, have you seen this guy? The character just said, well, he looks quite a bit like you.
Yeah.
You could have made some reference, oh, is he your brother? You could do something like that. Some gag, but they never even played the gag up that he looked like Mulder. So it's simply for the audience.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I thought the one-liners were pretty lame in this one. I didn't really think anything was funny. In fact, I think the first one out of Duchovny's mouth, I'd kind of groan, and I'm like, wow. The have it our way joke. Here's the tone being set for the stuff that's going to come out of Mulder's mouth.
This actually works really well with talking about the detective, that a lot of the staging in the episode seems very tropey for us as the viewer. And not the character, even though it's through the character's eyes. It takes you out that we're not in the real world. That's okay, but then again, it's hard to establish pathos when we're not in the real world. The buttons scene that you referred to earlier, none of that's going to happen in the real world. So there's so many scenes where I'm thinking, who cares about ear prosthetics when you're telling me that everyone in that kitchen in a fast food restaurant is carrying around a button that they only wear one day a week? Maybe.
The most realistic one is the jerk, right? Because he doesn't have it, because he says, like, why should I carry it when we only wear it one day a week? Right. He should have been complimented as the smart one and all of that. When they first go into it, I was almost kind of hoping that they wouldn't have any of that, like, corporate speak or anything like that. And I like the little scene where he's walking in, and because I'm like, oh, please don't make him like everybody hates this guy or whatever. And he's not, you know, he's walking through and everybody's being nice to him. You know, he says hi to his bosses, everything. The girl at the counter even gives him a kind of a, maybe I'm a little interested in you look. And then they have to do the thing, the button. But I agree with you on that.
I want to go to that scene that you talked about there, where he first walks in the restaurant, which is a highlight for the episode in a lot of ways.
Wow. It's
really well directed. You start off thinking,
with Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time. No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Oh, the Darewood Sphinx character is going to be a jerk when he interacts with him. They center it, but they don't play it too much. And then they subvert your very subtle expectations. Mm-hmm. And then I did not pick up from the woman coworker that she might have anything. In fact, I just picked up that they're just friends. This isn't going anywhere. And the episode doesn't play that. And I was so thankful, unlike so many other television shows that would play that angle up and waste time with a pointless romance subplot that just is creepy. So
I'm not saying it's huge, but I felt that there was at least a very friendly. It's not like, oh, you're the dweeb at work and I don't want to have anything to do with you and whatever. There's some nice normalcy there for at least a moment before it all goes to hell.
I thought it was a well done scene, well acted, well shot. And three cheers for that. Speaking of Mulder's behavior, throughout the entire episode, it's almost as if he's flirting with Rob, dropping by unattended, making these little quips and leaving.
Oh my God, yes.
It's very odd. And
there's
scene after scene, but one that really bothered me is Mulder, as this detective, walks into a room that there's a garbage bag on the floor, knowing that everything's happening, doesn't look around. Shouldn't a detective be looking around? Just look around a house, you know, glance, turn around, do something. But it's so forced. We did not need that scene.
It's because that, well, the director's trying to cause some tension there about will Mulder look at the bag or not look at the bag. And, you know, and Rob keeps looking at the bag. It is kind of stupid because I was thinking if Mulder sees it and asks about it, I hope Rob says, you have no business asking about that. Like, well, you don't know what I'm throwing away. I could be throwing away meat. There was this whole thing about throwing meat away at the restaurant. He could be throwing away meat there. At home, it's like it didn't really look like blood. It looked like reddish, you know, whatever liquid or whatever. But I totally agree with you. It got onto the verge of creepy with Mulder and the guy. And I was even thinking that, like, he could never have gotten away with that today if this, you know, was being filmed today. It's like, Rob, please tell this guy to get the hell out of your apartment because he's being really creepy.
To be clear, I get the tension angle with the bag. Yeah. You didn't need the bag. He just had a bathtub full of blood for some reason. Somehow there was so much blood in one shirt that it made the entire bathtub turn into blood.
Yeah.
It's some crazy communion wine action happening. But you don't need the bag. You have a bathtub that he probably has not had time to clean up. So you could just leave the bathroom door ajar.
Yeah.
And Mulder's looking around and you think, is Mulder going to ask to look around the house?
Yeah.
Yes or no? That's your tension. Instead, every time I've seen this episode, I remember this scene more than anything. I am stressed out about that blood liquid hitting that white carpet. That's what I'm thinking about during that scene because it's like an inch away. And you think there better be a lot of Scotch guard. Or this is going to be
bad. That's what Rob was really worried about.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, my landlord, my deposit's gone at this point.
I guess we get a little Mulder characterization, you know, his complimenting this guy about how clean his apartment is. And then he's kind of like, you know, in my apartment. And he makes that gesture with his hands where he kind of spreads, you know, like he doesn't say anything. He's like, my apartment, like, I guess a cute little moment in the middle of some creepiness.
Mulder is so focused on cleanliness, you think that would be a time to like, oh, look at how clean the kitchen is, and then walk over and like peer in the bathroom and create tension that way. But you're commenting on how clean it is, and there's a garbage bag sitting in the middle of the floor, and you don't look at it.
This kind of goes into what you're saying, is that there's an opening in what's going on in the script that they could have gone with the angle of Mulder trying to buddy up to Rob and get him to feel very comfortable, and then hopefully get him, you know, talking and that whole thing. And this, it's funny because this does sort of work into a line much later in the episode, which is really my most favorite line. I won't say it now because I know we're jumping around. You kind of open the door there with that little bit of dialogue back and forth at when they're in the apartment together, and then you don't, you know, you don't follow that along. Mulder just kind of keeps, like, gets kind of stalkerish.
well,
or Columbo-ish. Again, he starts not harassing, but you know, bugging the crap out of Rob.
Your analogy's right. It is very Columbo. It's very goofy and flirty and jokey, but it also makes it feel drug out.
Yeah.
That goes back to why I think there was plenty of time to explore other angles in this episode, because there's scene after scene. Why does Mulder ask one question and then leave? And you think, oh, he's just taunting him. Okay, but do we need that taunting scene 4 times? 5 times? How many murders do we need to see?
Well, yeah.
Even though they're still just trying to solve the one, we don't actually need any of the others. You could resolve the plot with the same murder. That doesn't mean that the murder should be cut. I'm not complaining. I'm not saying any of that. I'm just saying there's space.
I'm getting what you're saying. And even if I don't totally agree, I see exactly what you're saying here. If this was a movie length thing, I think we could have done some really great things here, and this could have been the greatest, most sympathetic, focused monster of the week ever.
I just find myself having more sympathy for the fluke monster in the host times than I do for this character.
Okay.
And that is not ideal. So again, there's a lot of things I like about this episode. So I don't want to feel like I'm trash talking it, but that weak link of,
wait, I feel bad. What are those things? I'm just kidding. I'm just giving you a hard time.
One thing I do like about the episode, and one performance that I think gets the balance right, knows what kind of episode he's in and still plays it charismatic, but still is cartoonish, is Mark Pellegrino, who played Durwood Sphinx. What did you think of his performance?
I didn't. I mean, no, I like Rob better. I thought he was completely one note. Not bad, but that was a very typical character. He's the jerk at work who finds out about what's going on, you know, the blackmail thing. I want money. I want your TV set. I'll let them know, and puts the main character in a bad position. To me, if I had to say there was sort of a weak link in this episode, it might be that character and that actor. But then I don't think there was enough there for the actor to do anything with.
Nearly every character is pretty restrained in what they have, but especially that character. But what I'm getting at is the performance, with how little there was at least charming. Not that it was a complicated masterwork of acting.
Yeah.
But the actor brought an energy to it, a threat level and a little degree of humor that was, I think, appropriate for the script and appropriate for the direction.
Okay.
That fit what I think Manners and everybody else was going for.
Yeah. Okay. And again, this is one of these times where I don't necessarily agree with you, but I totally see what you're saying.
And that's why I like talking to you. We can be friends, and we'll save our long feud, boiling vendetta face-off for another 10 years.
All right, but I let's wait until we get to the psychiatrist, and then I think maybe it's gonna get rough and nasty and bubble over.
Yeah. Since you like the therapist, let's talk about the therapist. We talked about this creature. We have a creature, a humanoid. So as a person, maybe not be standard human, but let's say a person in Rob who has super strength, super hearing, can shoot a tongue out of his mouth and puncture people's skulls, can afford that apartment in L.A. We're getting more fantastic as we go. Can afford prosthetics, all of this on a fast food job.
Yeah.
But is that still, I think, is more believable than someone working in a fast food restaurant and having that corporation pay for a therapist and that therapist to actually spend time trying to help this person? To me, that is crazier than aliens abducting a fast food milkshake machine, I think.
I'm beginning to think that there's a missing character in this episode, and it's the character who funds Rob. I don't know who it is. See, this is that part of that we needed to know more about his background or whatever, like a parent figure. Okay, Jim? I'm going to throw this out to your listeners.
Okay.
Everybody listening right now, we want to know how you would rewrite this episode. And we're going to start with Russ.
The beauty is, unintentionally, I think Manners did. The final scene, the therapist comes to visit Rob.
Mm-hmm.
That would never happen in his apartment. No way. In no world. That is foregrounding. The therapist behavior. Let's go. I'm going to scroll down to my notes. Here we go. Therapist visits. Well, then, consider me a friend. Sounds like you are tired of feeling guilty. You killed that man, didn't you? Can you tell me why you did it? Quick question. Why is she confronting someone that she thinks is a killer alone in his apartment? That is not rational behavior.
No, we never said she was smart.
But this is the best part here. You say you don't believe in monsters. How about now? Rob takes off his wig. All of a sudden, she's scared because he was wearing a wig. Now she's scared. He hasn't taken off the ears, hasn't taken off the eyes, but now she's scared because of the wig. That doesn't make sense. You poor man, what you go through. Rob, be that good person I know you mean to be. This goes back to all of the time spent in this episode on other things repeating. You're telling me with a total of 8 minutes that's implied that he spent with her? Because every time he shows up, he immediately leaves. So I don't really get a sense that he's spent, and it couldn't be more than a week or two, that he has spent more than maybe 8 minutes, an hour with this person, and now she has a complete psych profile and knows the good person he means to be, goes to visit in this place alone. It is because she is like him. That is how the episode could have worked. They could have been that sort of twist. She called him in. We didn't see anybody else go in to visit the therapist.
I like
Why does she have the job at the fast food restaurant? She could be either a parent, a relative, or somebody else who's involved in a government project that created him. It would explain all of that insanity and irrationality. And I was waiting for that twist to happen every time I watched this episode, thinking it's got to. It's not a great twist because that doesn't save the episode.
It's going to happen this time. Wait, I can see it. He says, you say you don't believe in monsters, and he pulls the wig off. And instead of being scared, she says, that's because I don't see myself as a monster. And then she pulls her wig off.
It writes itself. But
and then they start mating in some weird kind of alien thing.
You go that direction. I'm gonna go over here for a bit. This is one where we'll part ways until our 10-year face-off on the summit of Mount Shasta.
But you know what? But there's not enough time. There's not enough time. But you know what? You won't believe me, but that did sort of cross my mind that there was a little bit more to her. Actually, I think the twist is when she reaches out and says, oh, you poor man. Maybe she went overboard with the looking scared thing, and that goes into that cartoonishness that you're talking about. She should have been directed to not. It would be like a little bit of a shock when he pulls the wig off, and then she could have get more scared maybe once he, you know, reveals the thing with the eyes and the mouth and the ears and all of that. But I actually kind of liked that when she said, "Oh, you poor man," because I thought, "Oh, She's like into monsters and stuff. I think she's an incredibly multi-layered character, and you just don't see it, and you have something in for her, and I don't get it.
You're misreading. I think that everything about her behavior up to that point makes no sense. It's not, again, we're not in the real world. None of this would happen. Yeah. But that scene where she says, "You poor man, what you must go through," as opposed to you, I don't pick up on anything sexual or romantic there.
No, I don't. I'm goofing on that or whatever. But I did like that she didn't remain scared, and that she would go so far as to have empathy at that moment when she might be facing her death right there, and that she actually reaches out and kind of strokes his cheek or whatever. And then I like the look on his face, because he didn't expect that either. I think that's a good moment. But yeah, we don't really have any time to explore that whatsoever.
I will just say, I agree with you in that "you poor man, what you must go through" is a highlight of the episode. Mm-hmm. And I think that moment is really nice. And like you said, there isn't enough time. And what if that would have happened in Act 3? Maybe, let's say, 2/3 of the way into the episode.
Yes.
The second or third visit to the therapist.
Yes.
And then she, because of patient-client confidentiality, doesn't know that he has actually committed the murder. Or maybe that she isn't even aware of the murder, but he's seen a therapist and discloses this information, and we have this exploration and dynamic.
Yep.
Personally, I think that would be a lot easier than going for the cheap gag of going to Overeaters Anonymous.
Yeah. Would you have seen her becoming an enabler?
I don't think we'd need to. I think we didn't even need to spend that much time. I think we could at least have her wrestling with this with him in a sympathetic manner. He could talk about how he thinks about, "Is my only option to kill myself?" Because that's really what's going on at the end.
Yeah,
that's what could have been played throughout the episode. Instead of all these jokes about, "Oh, I've got an eating disorder."
Yeah.
Ah, how many times do I need to hear that joke when it all comes down to this? I can't be what I'm not, which is throughout the episode in some ways it works. But about the fact that, can he live in this world? And does that mean he's going to have to kill himself? Does that mean he needs to just become a killer? And they deal with some of this, but I think it would have been more interesting if they could foreground it. And it'd be a lot easier to foreground it and explore it in a natural way in a therapist setting or through a hobby or books he's reading. But it's just everything's repetition. Everything is food.
I'm struggling with trying to explain why I liked the therapist character. And I think and whether this is fair or not, a fair assessment is, I think because I could see the potential. And I do this a lot with shows where I like something that's not necessarily there or on the surface that I think that I see potential in it. It goes back to the first episode with Darren McGavin that we talked about, the secretary that names the X-Files. I glommed onto that character immediately because I started to see the potential there, and I wanted to see more of her and get more stories about her and all of that. Beyond that, I like the therapist.
Well, I think she's a good actor, and she doesn't have a lot to work with, and does a good job.
I do this all the time. She looks somewhat familiar to me. Was she in any other episode?
She's done an enormous amount of television, but nothing else 10-13 related that I can see.
Okay. Here's what I was hoping at the end, before he commits suicide by FBI. I thought it would be interesting if she somehow stops Rob from doing that, and she says that she's going to work with him. Wouldn't it have been interesting to not have him die, not have, you know, the monster be killed or whatever? But that they arrest him, and that we know that she's going to start working with him, whether or not he can be reformed or they can take care of his little problem or something like that. I almost thought that there was going to be something like that. Or it even could have been that she steps in front of Rob and she gets shot at the end when he starts becoming aggressive.
All fair points. And to try and be fair myself, in the previous interactions with the therapist, some of these things are hinted at, mm-hmm. like the deep down aside, even the worst of us wants to be good, but it feels hollow because mm-hmm. she doesn't know anything about him and not enough time is spent between the two of them. On one hand, then we get the potential of all of these things you're talking about. We could have established a bigger relationship and a pull between the two, and they could have continued on, or it could end the way they did, and that just creates more drama and tension, too. It would have made the episode a lot more interesting. I think it would have to be a lot more serious.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Maybe cut down yep. on some of the other characters. At that point, we would definitely not need the detective. We don't need Darewood Spinks anymore, or at least play down a lot more. So just something to distract the FBI, but we don't need to spend any time for it. And instead make this a relationship between Rob and the therapist. If the goal here is to make a Tombs that we can empathize with, you know, I was a teenage Tombs.
that would have been a good title.
That being said, one caveat of a scene, it's classic X-Files, classic manners, and it's well done. Is it necessary? No. Is it exceptional? No, but it's good and I'm going to praise it. Is the scene where Rob visits Durwood's apartment and we get a little bit of grit, we get a little bit of grime, some smoke in the air, a little mm-hmm. bit of tension. Mm-hmm. We get the nice transformation scene in the closet. It's exceptionally well shot and lit, and going to give it some praise. And one little caveat before I turn it over to you is I froze the frame. In case you're curious, the prescription bottle that Durwood had that yeah. he stepped on is yeah. for lithium.
I wondered what it was that he was taking. He was taking lithium. Very interesting. Almost adds a layer to that character. Jeez.
I think the character has a little bit of depth because if you're going to play the ex-con, you're yeah. going to play him generally in a cartoonish show like this as negative all the way through. Yep. When you first meet him, he just seems fine. He seems like he's trying to play ball and get along with folks. When things become a hassle, he goes over and gets cigarettes. But he doesn't actually bully anybody until he solves the mystery and knows who the killer is. And then he tries to exploit the situation because he's in a bad situation. Yeah. It's not high art. It's not Shakespeare. But to give Gilligan credit, it's a little bit better than that type of character has been treated in the past.
What did you think about the scene where Rob takes Durwood's baseball bat to his apartment?
I thought it was okay and that it shows the desperation
yep.
of Rob, and it shows some degree of creativity, yep. but it also shows we live in a fantasy world.
Okay.
Multiple reasons. No one sees Durwood enter or leave the building at that point. Same thing. No one saw him kill that detective in the car and dispose of the body and drive the car somewhere else. Yeah. All of the noise and screams in that apartment building, no one, this is LA, no one heard or saw anything. We're continually having to amp up how this world works and what the rules are. And that scene, again, took me a little bit out of it. It worked for characterization.
Yeah.
And it worked for moving the plot on. And then it follows up with this scene where Mulder picks up the bat with no gloves on. It's this prime
my
piece of evidence.
Exactly. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
and he starts feeling it around. And
yeah. Well, okay. one could say that he saw through it immediately and what it didn't matter.
Oh, yes, yes. It's just classic Mulder. I don't consider that a flaw. I mean, this is somebody who puts his hands in alien goop and tastes it.
I saw the scene with taking the baseball bat to his apartment as somewhat clever on the part of Rob to think of it, but also as a pressure valve in a way too. Like he's doing it because it's going to work. He thinks it's going to work for him to pass the blame onto Durwood or to act like Durwood's still alive. But then it also serves the secondary purpose of being a pressure, release for him to get, you know, get out some of his frustrations by wrecking his own apartment. There's three scenes that I'd like to call out if you want to do this now. Two that I want to praise and one that I definitely don't want to.
Sure. The only thing I'll say is on the baseball bat scene, as we've seen the character before, seems to be smart enough to be able to dispose of cars and bodies without mm-hmm. anybody catching him.
Yeah.
Would probably be smart enough to do that thing with his baseball bat at night, make it quick.
Yeah.
And then come up with some way to actually make it look like somebody entered the building or not. So the fact that it's during the day, I'm already in my head thinking, oh, how's he going to explain this? That being said, everything you said, both for plot driving and character driving, the scene yeah. is a success. And if you're just watching this and you're just going through the episode, it works.
Yeah.
So I'm going to turn it over to you. Hit me with your scene okay. highlights.
Here's where Rob gets really stupid to me, is that he goes to the Overeaters Anonymous meeting. He's already under suspicion. He already knows that Mulder's dogging his heels. He has to figure that Mulder's, you know, probably watching him, even following him. So what does he do? He goes to an Overeaters Anonymous meeting and gets up and starts talking about hunger and for meat. To me, that was just like he just gives it all up at that moment. You know, who's to say that Mulder didn't follow him to that meeting and he's sitting somewhere in the back of that room and hears it all. So he's not thinking at that point. I thought that was, you know, pretty dumb of the character.
I thought it was okay in the sense that, like with the therapist, is that he wanted to confess. He wants yeah. to. And that's where there's a much better episode buried in here. And I'm not saying that in the sense of it's a mm-hmm. bad episode, but in the yeah. sense there is a lot that could be done with this premise.
Yeah.
But here is somebody who is hiding their true self. And because of a conflict with how society works, they are struggling. But at this point, they can't take it anymore. They can't. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily feel comfortable expressing it to the therapist right now, but they're able to in this group, in this anonymous setting. Even if Mulder heard it, he's still talking about meat. Mulder already at this point knows, like yeah. you said, knows who this is. It's a matter of desperation in that it works for me. I'll disagree. I get where you're coming from, but I disagree in that we're seeing this character losing control. And that's the premise, is that he just started murdering about a month ago because he is losing control. And here, the way he's talking about it is if he is losing control while he's talking about it. So he can't help it at this point, but it's in the therapeutic yeah. setting in a sense. It has an analog with the therapist session. And so I don't mind it. I don't like the cuts to the people in the audience who are like licking their lips and it's playing it up a little well, cartoon. It's a little crude.
I knew you would say that it's cartoonish, and I do believe it. But I also think there is something interesting that in the fact that Rob is talking about one thing and the audience is interpreting it in their own way. I do feel like this is one of the highlights of that actor's acting, Chad mm-hmm. Donnell.
I agree. It is a good performance there. I totally
agree.
His
descriptions and the fervor of it and you know, I mean, the almost like the lust of talking about meat and all of that. I thought he delivered that all very, very well. Even though I think still that on Rob's part as a character, it was just an incredibly stupid thing to do. The two scenes that I really like, that I think are really well done. I love it when he goes back to work and he's working the grill and it's meat and then it changes and it's the brains.
It's a fun effect, a little CG, but it still holds up.
Yes.
It's cute.
I thought it held up well. I do like that. And I like it better than when he looks at the one guy in the audience at the meeting, the bald guy who turns around and then he sees like the brain in his head. I actually like the brains on the grill scene much, much better. And then my favorite line, to say my favorite line, it might be like the only line that really stands out to me that I really liked. It's kind of late in the episode. He's being confronted by Mulder and Scully, and he says the thing like, what is this good cop and insane cop? Now, I thought that was funny. Because number one, who would ever have thought of Dana as good cop? But then he just nails Mulder perfectly with insane cop.
I agree. Going back to the humor thing as a final note, just to bring up, is when the therapist at one of their meetings talks the scene with the mirror and brings up the city poverty. That's a scene I thought that didn't work, but the attempt at humor was interesting considering how overt all the other jokes were in there. The Peter Jennings joke was really underplayed, and I think she could have maybe amped it up a little bit, but it works. But otherwise, besides that line, that scene falls flat for me. Yeah. Again, it's something else could work. It was too much of a repetitive pastiche. We have him watching the Overeaters Anonymous tape that he cites when he gets out of the car at the beginning, like, you can do this. And the guy talking about his struggle with food. We go to Overeaters Anonymous. We see this catchphrase, pop psychology, repeated. This is the space when you talk about there not being enough room that we can trim. This is another example of a scene we could pad out. But there are scenes that work, like some of those that you mentioned. And kudos to that. As a final little bit of trivia, that this was filmed before the Sixth Extinction arc was.
Conclusion.
Sixth Extinction 1 and 2 was filmed before. It's surprising. That's fun.
This is literally the first thing that was filmed for the entire season.
That's what it looks like,
according to the... Yeah. And that was because of having to work with Anderson and Duchovny's schedules, right?
It is because of their film schedules, yes.
And that's interesting that it's this episode, and this is the first episode of the season.
Although she doesn't add much to the plot, I did also like the neighbor Sylvia and the actor that played her. She did a good job, too.
Yeah. But, well, my heart jumped a little bit when they cut from the meeting, and then the two of them are coming in the building, and there's some joy there. That's the happiest Rob is in this entire thing. It's a real shame because then he has to turn around and kill her. I tell you what I actually hated in this episode is the stomach sounds, the gurgling stomach sounds. Now, talk about cartoony. I don't know what it was, but those really aggravated and irritated me.
I have that same issue with just the chomp sounds of when people were murdered. I think it's a production thing. They didn't bother me as much as the voice affect, but it's hard in the sense of, are they in universe? Are we getting them as the audience? Or is that how loud they are to everybody else? And if that's how loud your stomach is grumbling, maybe we should... are you doing okay? You need a snack bar?
I got the impression that only Rob could hear that.
And in that sense, I don't think it needed to be that loud.
Okay, sure.
And they could play it a little bit different. They could muffle it and make it sound more internal. Yeah. And so that we get the cue, but it's not in your face. Extreme noise rumbling 2000.
They could have shown, if it was only that we were supposed to believe that pretty much only Rob was hearing it, they could have shot it in a way that you actually had more of a close-up of Rob and you hear the sounds. To me, that would have given the impression that it's like he's hearing it or it's some sort of more internal thing. But yes, because there should have been characters saying, the hell is that? Is that your stomach?
But it did bother me. But considering how many things bothered me, I am not judging you.
Okay. Thanks.
I'm going to stay the top curmudgeon of this podcast for now.
I'm coming off pretty good in this one, man. Compared to you, I almost seem like I love this episode. And remember, you were a 5 and I was a 6.
Yeah.
So it was only 1.1, number difference there.
I'm just a cruel, horrible person.
I think if you could just embrace that therapist, you would have come up to a 6 with me.
The thing is that the therapist was about one of those points in my score because I actually thought she was doing a good job, except for a few things here and there, like the mirror scene. Okay. I like the therapist.
I should have said if you weren't so bothered by Rob's voice, you could have come up to a 6 with
you.
Me.
Got it.
There you go. Okay, that's what it is.
Guilty as charged.
All right, no problem.
I feel horrible about that, actually. Do you have anything to plug? Any recent projects to share with the listeners?
In mid to late August, I have an official Green Hornet novel coming out from Moonstone Books, who did my Kolchak novel, and I'm super excited about it. It's now in Diamond Previews, the catalog for comic shops. So you could, you can in July. I was going to say, by the time this is out, you couldn't order it from there. But you should, by July, you should be able to go to the moonstonebooks.com website and pre-order it there. But it's an official Green Hornet novel that's based on the 60s Van Williams, Bruce Lee TV series. I'm really, really, really proud of it. It's a very pulpy, noirish crime story. And I was so excited to be able to work with that character, and that's a bucket list character. I keep hitting these, you know, X-Files, Kolchak, Green Hornet. I keep hitting these bucket list characters and having a lot of fun with it. So that's the big thing that's going on right now.
Congrats on that, and
thank you. I'm sorry, the other fun thing is that I'm doing shows again. Like, OMG. I did one last week, and I've got another one coming up in a week. And I've got a few more into July and August. Things are opening up again, and shows are happening. I'll almost always have the X-Files book with me. So if anybody sees me at a show and you want to get a copy of the X-Files book, I should have it at my table.
And do you have the dates and locations on your website?
Yeah, it would be on my Facebook page, the Beard, the Jim Beard fan page.
Congratulations on, again, the book and the upcoming shows. Thanks so much for joining us, Jim. And thanks so much to the listeners. Until next time, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This. The time is now. A Millennium podcast.
I will say that Rise of the Machines also kind of like argues against
Terminator 2, of course.
Back to where it was.
Like, Rise of the Machines, like, then goes, maybe they're both right, and shrugs its shoulders. It's like, maybe you can prevent Judgment Day, but only for a little while. And it's like, that's not an argument. Pick a side. Pick a lane. You can either change the past or you can't. None of this wishy-washy. You can change it sometimes, but you can't really change it. So it all balances out. Yeah, no, pick a damn side.
Frame to frame.
So what Hitchcock said about the film was that Bernard Herrmann's score was 33% of the effect of the film. So as a result of that, he doubled his salary, which I don't know how he worked those maths out, but hey.
Exactly, yeah.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about the score?
I mean, it's one of the greatest scores ever composed for a film. And it's, again, it's a fantastic example of misdirection, because you think that the jabbing, though it was written for a string-only orchestra, which is very unorthodox, because you think for a standard symphonic approach in a film score will mix tonalities from different host of instruments, strings, woodwinds, brass, percussion. This strips out everything except the strings, and the amount of emotional range that Bernard Herrmann is able to get out of it is really extraordinary.
Free with this month's issue.
You know what actually ruined it for them? That f***ing bass player with his stupid face.
Yes.
Pulling his absolutely stupid faces. Also, that weird, like, shaved-in parting that the singer had. Also.
If people knew a third song by Alien Ant Farm, this would have been it. Because this was on Tony Hawk Pro Skater 3.
Ah, that would be it. I know it from this CD and that, because I remember when one or the other happened, that the other had happened previously.
Yeah.
Good sentence, Ian. Well done. Like, he's got a good voice. That's the thing. He definitely likes Incubus.
Yeah. Glassjaw. Actually, even more so, Head Automatica.
Mm.
He's basically, if somebody ordered Daryl Palumbo,
from Wish,
but wanted extra annoyingness.
Yeah.
Then this is what they'd get.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast Pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at @wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening and keep watching the skies.